Good morning. I would like to call the meeting of the House Education Committee to order. It is 8:04 a.m. Monday, May 7th, 2025 in the Betty Davis Room, 106 in the Capitol. Members present to my right are Rep. Eichscheid, Rep. Co-Chair Himmelschut, myself, Co-Chair Story, then we have Rep. Schwanke, and then we have Rep. Dybert. Please let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take time to silence your cell phones for the meeting. I want to thank Cale Brown, the House Education Secretary from Records, and Zach Lawhorn from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today, and our co-chair aides, Claire Fordyce and Hemi Smith. Today, the House Education Committee has a full schedule. We will hold our final confirmation hearing for the governor's appointees to the University of Alaska Board of Regents. And today we have a student regent, Fernando Escobar, who will be speaking with us. Then we will take up two previously heard bills, House Bill 176 by Representative Carrick, House Bill 212 by myself, Rep. Story, including an explanation of fiscal notes from the Department of Education and any further information they would like to add. Finally, we will have our first reading for the committee, House Bill 59, State Tribal Education Compact by the governor. I'm going to work very hard to keep the committee on a timeline today so we can have as much time as possible on the tribal compacting bill. So I believe online we have Fernando Escobar. I'm going to start with welcoming him to the committee. To please unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and I want to say, and this is posted on BASIS, there are a letter of introduction from Mr. Escobar, and then we have a few letters of support, and we will be taking public testimony on this nominee later today. So, Mr. Escobar, please welcome, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you very well.
Perfect. My name is Fernando Escobar. I was born and raised here in Kodiak. I'm currently attending the University of Alaska Fairbanks as a first-generation student. I recently wrapped up my first year at UAF, where I've been actively involved with the student government and campus life. For my student government, I served as a senator for my fall semester, and now I serve as the director of student advocacy and public relations. Public service has always been both a passion and commitment for me. I have worked to represent and support juvenile delinquents, advocate for the voices of countless students, and engage in essential community service. Public service is a fundamental principle of my teaching philosophy. It was an honor to be selected as the next student regent of the University of Alaska Board of Regents. I am proud and excited to continue representing my peers in a different capacity. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. Are there any questions from the committee for Mr. Escobar? Rep. Schwanke.
Thank you, Chair Story. Through the chair, Mr. Escobar, thank you for being here. I just have one simple question. Why do you want to serve on the Board of Regents?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Schwanke. The reason why I want to serve as a student regent is I think we're entering certain times right now. And I think we need to have a good and strong student representative on the Board of Regents who is able to essentially advocate and be able to fully represent the student voices across the system. And, you know, that's over 18,000 students. And so having the student representative or the student regent be able to do that is very powerful and very influential. And I think that's one reason why I want to serve is to represent my students.
Follow up. Thank you for that, Mr. Escobar. I'm going to dig a little bit deeper here. You said going into certain times. Could you describe what your biggest concerns are?
I think some of the concerns are at the federal level. We're facing some issues on education, and I think the Board of Regents should be focusing on preserving the integrity of the university. And also, as well, you know, at the state level, we're going to be facing a financial issue here soon. And I think being ready to face that financial issue to preserve the university and the integrity of it will help us out in the end.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? I see two more. I see one from Rep. Underwood and one from Rep. Eichheit.
Thank you, Chair Story. Through the chair, thank you, Fernando Escobar, for being here today. My question would be, as you've been preparing for this role, have you heard any feedback as to why they don't have this position on the Board of Regents right now, or any negative feedback been given to you? Or they do have one? Okay, so you can disregard my question.
Thank you, Rep. Eichheit.
Thank you, Co-Chair Story. Through the chair, Mr. Escobar, just mostly a comment. I was very impressed by your introductory email that I received and your resume, and I just want to say from where I sit, I think you're a credit to the state of Alaska, so thank you for stepping up to put your name in the hat and represent your colleagues on the Board of Regents.
I do not see any more questions, so I want to open up public testimony on the governor's appointee to the University of Alaska Board of Regents, student Fernando Escobar. And I'm going to first go in the room. Oh, gavel. So I'm opening public testimony. I am looking in the room, and I do not see anyone who is here to testify on that. So I will go online, and I see... we have a couple testifiers online. So I am going to go first to Paul Jacobson, if you could please, or Pat Jacobson, excuse me, if you could please unmute yourself and begin your testimony, and we limit it to 2 minutes.
Good morning. I'm Pat Jacobson, a 55-year resident of Kodiak and retired teacher. I'm pleased to testify regarding the confirmation of Fernando Escobar as student regent on the UA Board of Regents. I served for 8 years on that board and worked with several student regents. Like anyone serving on any boards, student regents should have an understanding and passion for the organization's mission, be prepared, be respectful, be on time, conduct themselves professionally, and be able and willing to dedicate the time needed to do the best job possible. They need to have the ability and willingness to participate actively while respecting the opinions of others. Fernando demonstrates those qualities in all settings. He has house sat and done yard work for me. We've often visited about the university, his goals, and life in general. He's always been reliable, paid attention to detail, had a positive attitude and great work ethic, as well as a level of maturity I haven't often seen in a teenager. Mr. Escobar is not your typical young, intelligent person. He's a highly motivated, dedicated young man of boundless energy. He transitioned easily to UAF last fall. He took a mix of honors and general education requirement courses. He's a climate scholar and has also been involved with the Honor Student Advisory Council. He's treasurer of the Anthropological Society and is involved with the pre-law club as he plans to become a lawyer. I've known few young college students who have been so impressive in all respects. I am most pleased to recommend the confirmation of Fernando Escobar as student regent, and I'm confident that he will serve the UA system and the state of Alaska exceptionally well. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for your service to the state of Alaska. Next, we will go to Betty Walters. Please introduce yourself. Unmic yourself, unmute yourself, and then you will have 2 minutes.
Good morning, Co-Chair Story and Hemshute and members of the committee. I am Betty Walters, a Kodiak community member, educator, and a volunteer. It is a pleasure to be with you online today. I first met Fernando Escobar as a sophomore at Kodiak High School. He got my attention as a typical teen after school working for his student government association. I followed his education and community activities through today. Fernando is an admirable, capable, observant, inquisitive, dependable, and committed to his work. as well as conscientious. In the essence of time today, my letter of recommendation for Fernando for this position offers examples of my observations. Hopefully you have that available to you. I urge you to support Fernando Escobar for the student regent position on the University of Alaska Board of Regents. Thank you for your attention and your time today.
And thank you, Ms. Walters, and thank you, I believe, for your work when you were many years as an educator and then former acting commissioner of education. So thank you. Next, we will go to Sophia May, who's calling from Fairbanks. Please unmute your mic, identify yourself for the record, and begin your testimony. You will have 2 minutes.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the House Education Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Sophie May, and I am the Student Success Coordinator for the University of Alaska Fairbanks Honors College. I'm delighted to speak in strong support of Fernando Escobar's candidacy for the University of Alaska Student Regent. I worked closely with Fernando since he joined our program in August 2024, and from the very beginning he stood out, not only because of his professionalism and attention to detail, but also for his kindness, humility, and the energy he brings to every space he's in. In a cohort of nearly 200 incoming honor students, Fernando immediately distinguished himself as a thoughtful, engaged, and highly organized individual. He quickly became a trusted leader within the honors community and now serves as a member of the Honor Student Advisory Council. In this role, he has contributed meaningfully to several initiatives, always with a focus on collaboration with administration and student-centered outcomes. Beyond the Honors College, Fernando is deeply involved in student governance. He previously served as a senator for the Associated Students of the University of Alaska Fairbanks, or ASUAF for short, and currently holds the position of Public Relations and Student Advocacy Director. Over the past year, I had the opportunity to work with ASUAF on developing onboarding and training resources for new officers, and Fernando was absolutely instrumental in that effort. He offered thoughtful feedback and even helped facilitate important discussions between students and university administrators. Fernando brings a rare combination of big picture vision and meticulous execution. He is smart, responsible, and deeply committed to the students, staff, and faculty within the UA system. I have no doubt he would make an exceptional student regent, and I give him my strongest possible endorsement. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. I will now close public testimony. Thank you, Mr. Escobar, for coming before the committee today. We appreciate your interest in the position. In accordance with AS39.05.080, the Education Committee held a hearing on the following appointee, Fernando Escobar. A signature on this report does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individuals during any further sessions. With that, we will sign the hearing report on the governor's appointee to the University of Alaska Board of Regents. We will take a brief at ease to sign the confirmation hearing form. call the Education Committee back to order. Next, we are going to consider House Bill 176, University of Alaska Fees, by Representative Carrick and legislative staff. No amendments were submitted by the deadline. I'm going to invite Rep. Carrick to come forward and her committee aide, Mr. Tsukeo, thank you. Sorry about that. Going to get it right the first time one of these days. So welcome, both of you. I would invite you, Representative Carrick, to offer any comments to the committee.
Good morning. For the record, Ashley Carrick, representing House District 35 in West Fairbanks. I don't really have any additional comments to give, but I just remind committee members that House Bill 176 does two things. It provides fee transparency through itemized billing for students on their course registration. And then secondly, when a new fee is implemented or when fees are raised, there would be a requirement for an email communication to notify students of those changes.
Thank you for those comments. Do I have any questions from the committee? I see no questions. Do we have a motion?
Yes, I move House Bill 176-34-LS0880/A from the House Education Committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Are there any objections? Without objection, then HB34-LS0880/A with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations has been moved out of the House Education Committee. So thank you. We're going to take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. And then my bill next, 212, is going to come up, so I'm going to pass the gavel over to Rep. Hemshute when we come back from our after we come back from our brief at ease.
Okay, we're back on record. And our next item of business for today's House Education Committee is House Bill 212, Local Contributions. Representative Story, if you and your staff, Tammy Smith, could put yourselves on record and provide any comments you'd like us to hear.
Thank you, Co-Chair Himshute and the Education Committee. I think where we ended off last time was we were needing to go over the fiscal notes. And so I'm just going to start with, if it's all right, Co-Chair Himshute, to invite Heather Heineken, I believe she's online or in the room, to go over the fiscal notes. And then we also are fortunate to have the commissioner here today. And then at your pleasure, I think it would be important to hear from her if she would like to make any comments. And then I'll come up afterwards and answer any questions. So thank you again for hearing the bill.
Sure. Okay. Ms. Heineken, Director Heineken, if you're online, could you unmute yourself and walk us through these fiscal notes?
Sure. Good morning, Co-Chair Himshu and Co-Chair Story and House Education Committee members. This is Heather Heineken. I'm the Director of Finance and Support Services for the Department of Education, for the record. And there are three fiscal notes for House Bill 212. The first one that I will review is the Public Education Fund, which is OMB component number 2804. And this fiscal note is based on the expectation that if House Bill 212 is passed, the Department of Education will no longer pass the federal disparity test for impact aid because the proposed language conflicts with the federal definition of current expenditures. Just for reference, in FY26 application, we're allowed 25% disparity between the lowest 5% and top 95% school district ADM with a difference of ADM. And for FY26, our application was 24.66. So currently we're close to that threshold. So based on the FY26 projected basic need, the fiscal note would be for FY27 and out years, the cost to the state for HB12, if the disparity test were not passed, would be $80,807,500. The second fiscal note is the foundation program, which is OMB component number 141. This is a $0 fiscal note, and it's just for reference, the funding mechanism is a general fund transfer to the public education fund. So the money is deposited into the public education fund, and this analysis is for explanation purposes only. And then the final fiscal note is Mount Edgecombe High School, which is OMB component number 1060. And that fiscal note is $1,571,900. And because the Mount Edgecombe is a division of the Department of Education, it's an interagency receipt. So this, again, is to increase their interagency receipt authority and to represent the transfer from the department. So, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
I'm wondering if we want to go maybe to the commissioner to see if she has additional comments and keep Director Heineken on the line, and then we can take all the questions together. We're trying to get through this portion of today's meeting by 8:50. So, Commissioner, welcome. Glad you're here.
Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair Himshute, as well as Co-Chair Story, who is presenting the bill, and Education Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak today and provide clarification for the record regarding some omitted context from the superintendent who provided you information from Juno in his presentation relating to deeds work and interest surrounding the Impact Aid program. Admittedly, a highly complex program, and this was provided to you on HB 212. While it is appropriate for a district superintendent to advocate for his particular district and his specific context, that is absolutely appropriate. Deed's role is to implement state law in a manner that serves all school districts across Alaska. So I'm going to share to see if in I know our finance folks, as a math teacher, even as a math teacher, sometimes it's difficult to understand the complexities that go into impact aid. So I'm going to try to break this down as my best teacher voice, if you will. So as a backdrop, DEED is currently evaluating potential regulatory changes related to the local contribution to ensure ongoing compliance with AS 1417-990 as it relates to the federal requirement under the Impact Aid Program, specifically the disparity test outlined in Section 7009 of ESEA, or the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. Our goal is to simply clarify for Alaska school districts what funds are included in the disparity test, as the state of Alaska's school funding formula includes impact aid in its basic need for local contribution for incorporated and non-incorporated boroughs. That means that the bipartisan statutory formula for school funding calls on, for incorporated areas, a basic need of 2.65 mils. Large incorporated cities, boroughs, they pay that. That's their local taxes. For those incorporated areas that might have military bases, or for REAAs, or regional education attendance areas, those that have federal property which cannot be taxed are provided impact aid. And what our state formula was designed to do is that if there's an ability for some type of tax in a local area, being an REAA, even without being an incorporated area, to have their impact aid count towards their basic need. So the idea that REAAs don't pay anything in local contributions, that's actually a falsehood. Those that have and receive impact aid, actually in the books like Anchorage does to demonstrate their basic need, no money comes to the state, but they have to ensure that they're paying a share. That is what happens presently with impact aid. Now, I guarantee anyone who is receiving impact aid would like to keep all of that and just receive it and give it to their schools. However, Alaska's legislators who designed this program thought that any taxable land that you could should be part of your taxes. That's the only thing that I can think of. And so whether you're incorporated or non-incorporated, there is somewhat of a local contribution for those that receive and can receive that locally. So although there have been no recent changes to the federal impact aid program itself, as was shared with you by the superintendent of Juneau, we have received feedback indicating that districts interpret Alaska school funding statute differently, particularly due to vague language that exists in the regulation that's on us, which has led to inconsistent applications of the state law for the funding formula and reporting. So recently, DEED became aware of a previously unaccounted for technical issue in our disparity analysis. More specifically, the treatment of revenues in the Special Revenue Fund for Transportation. School districts that receive funds for operations receive, through the federal government, food service funds. We have an account for transportation funds. And then, of course, we have the general operation funds, which is the ADM. So what we had previously done is only considered the operational funds in the disparity test. The federal government in 2019 said, actually, it needs to be all funds that you use for operations. School bus transportation is an operation of a school district. Hence, we had to start including that. With the technical assistance from the U.S. Department of Education Impact Aid Program, it was clarified again that the federal regulations require the consideration of all revenues available for current expenditures, not only those in districts' operating fund. While this was not a new federal interpretation, it certainly was new to DEED, so we had to start communicating this and look at how we were reporting to the federal government, because Alaska's statutory requirement for its school aid and funding has embedded impact aid within it. So we can't disregard impact aid if we're carrying out your funding formula, our funding formula. So the follow-up communication dated April 19, 2024, from the impact aid program staff reiterated that while they have no authority over our state regulations or funding formulas and have not requested us to change, their guidance affirms that all applicable revenues must be included in the disparity test under federal law. This highlights the importance that ensuring that Alaska's regulations fully reflect the scope of required revenues in order to maintain program eligibility, which is part, again, of our state's overall funding formula. It is a bipartisan statutory funding formula. It is also important to address information that was omitted from the superintendent's presentation, which could have confirmed DEED's actions. In that letter from Mr. Mohammed to Scott Kendall regarding the issue, it was quoted, "After learning of the existence of the Special Revenue Fund for Transportation, we, the Federal Impact Aid Program staff, applied the Impact Aid Programs, or IAP, statute and regulations, which contain no reference to revenues in an operating fund." So they just say any operations, not just operating fund. That's how we, prior to this time, were thinking operations, operating fund. But they're saying, no, your transportation is your operating fund, too. And so they wanted to affirm that all revenue for current expenditures must be considered in a disparity test. Characterizing this technical assistance as a change in interpretation from DEED is not correct in our view. This is coming from Mr. Mohammed, not DEED. However, it was new information to DEED. Further, DEED's memo statement that the Federal Impact Aid Program does not limit funds subject to the disparity test to a school district's operating fund, which the memo explains is the impetus for DEED's concern about the state's current regulation, is, quote, completely correct. That was omitted on Monday. So clarifications to the role of the impact aid with state regulations. To reiterate, the impact aid program has neither requested nor recommended that DEED change its regulations, as noted in that April 19 correspondence. However, state-level decisions fall outside the IAP's jurisdiction. It is our state who gets to decide our state formula. And presently in law, our state formula says we should utilize impact aid for basic need in REAAs. So in such places as Anchorage and Kodiak and Fairbanks that have large military bases, their taxpayers also receive somewhat of a reprieve because they can use that impact aid money as tax money for their basic need as well. So it's not just a benefit in unincorporated areas, it's a benefit impact aid in incorporated areas as well. So with this, the initiative to pursue regulatory clarification is solely on DEED, driven by our obligation to ensure compliance with federal law and Alaska law, which includes impact aid as a critical component of the state's school funding framework. I can guarantee you, if you chose to remove the impact aid, the districts would be happy. But you just heard the financial impact would be another $80 million in basic need provided to school districts by the state. Superintendent quoted Dr. Lisa Parity, executive director of the Alaska Council of School Administrators, who expressed concern over what she described as a sudden reinterpretation of the intent behind Alaska's funding formula. DEED values stakeholder input and acknowledges that the state's intent has remained consistent. However, this is not a reinterpretation. It is a response to new information regarding federal law and how the disparity test must be applied to all current expenditures, including those outside the operating fund in Alaska's formula. Dr. Parity also suggested that the proposed regulatory change may have minimal impact on the state's ability to pass the disparity test. While Deed appreciates that analysis, it is important to recognize that even marginal discrepancies can place compliance at risk. This year, four districts funded over the maximum limit, and our disparity range was over 24%. Mind you, Alaska's funding formula calls for a 25% disparity, for lack of a better word, between the richest districts and the poorest districts. Because federal reviews are retrospective, discrepancies, no matter how small, could trigger retroactive consequences. Just like the IRS can come back and have you pay, this is exactly what the Department of Education can do as well. DEED's objective is to take preventative and responsible action by aligning state regulations with federal expectations as well as current state law regarding the funding formula. We support the legislature's actions in whatever you want to do. Our job at DEED is to just carry out state law to all districts fairly. We support the language actually in the Senate CS for the CS of HB 69, your bill, and really commend Senator Keel for his leadership in advancing this. And the proposed bill provides clear and effective solution by specifying that all relevant revenues, regardless of fund classification, must be included in the disparity calculation in accordance with what the federal government says should be included. Participation in the disparity test is absolutely voluntary. We are the only state left that utilizes impact aid as a basic need. The state can decide not to do that and not have that be its equalizing formula of 25% disparity between our richest and our poorest. That's a judgment call for the state legislature. However, presently it is incorporated into our statutes and into our funding program, providing substantial financial and administrative benefits to the state. DEED is grateful for the legislators' engagement and leadership, ensuring that Alaska remains in good standing under federal requirements for a program in which we have chosen to participate due to the direct financial benefits, as well as the direct financial benefits to our communities. We're happy to answer any questions in regard to this. Again, we know it is a complex. The formula to calculate this comes from the audited accounts of school districts. So DEED's participation in this is doing the math, carrying out your formula to ensure that schools have the appropriate state aid. So thank you for speaking to you today, but the impact of this has consequences, and the state would have to decide if that is the avenue for which the state would like to go. Indeed, is happy to carry out the funding formula that the state decides is appropriate for its school districts. Thank you.
Are there questions from the committee? Representative Elam.
Thank you. Thanks for coming in and sharing with us. I guess my first question is the impact aid dollars, are those allowed to be used outside of specifically education? Is it just for education for the rural areas?
Thank you for that question through the co-chair to Representative Elam. Heather Heineken, can you answer that question?
Director Heineken, can you unmute yourself and put your name on record?
Yes, for the record, this is Heather Heineken through the chair to Rep. Elam. I believe your question is, are the districts allowed to spend those on other things? Impact aid dollars are included as part of their general operations budget, so Fund 100. So anything that would fit in Fund 100 would be something that the impact aid dollars are spent on.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Forgive the ignorance if I'm missing something here, but it sounds like urban school districts that provide municipal funding in addition to sometimes the impact aid, is it not being calculated properly in that the additional dollars are being given to school districts? Because, I mean, you see this sort of disparity thing going on whenever we look at the graphs. Some people are spending significantly more than outside of the cap, or maybe they're spending below the floor that they're setting. Is that kind of what's being driven here?
Through Co-Chair Hemshoot to Representative Elam, our state formula has a minimum that you must spend, and that's, you know, that basic need. And there is a 25% sway between a range that you can spend up to. What's happening is the impact aid is simply a local contribution, just like the 2.65 mils. And someone who actually has a tax base and impact aid can use those together, but only has to, at the base, provide 2.65. What's happening is in four districts, the top level, to keep equalization across Alaska's districts so we don't have the Matthew effect that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, you have set in our formula a 25% range that you can give. What's happening is that local areas, boroughs that collect taxes, are providing additional funds to their school districts for operations. Now, there are allowable expenses that perhaps that they can provide for, but for operations of schools, to keep the operations of schools between the 25%, those are what we have to calculate. So essentially, yes, more, they're providing more funding than the state formula allows for, because the state formula is built around the 25%. And so how they figure out that, and the reason the state formula chose 25% might have been so that they can use impact aid as a basic need and allow that.
Follow up? So if my understanding is correct, right, because, I mean, the formula is a spider web of numbers, so I, again, could have something wrong here. But it's a combination of ADM and the 2.5 or 2.65 mil and the impacts, but then also a certain value of property values in addition to that. Does that play a part in the equation at all?
Thank you. Through Co-Chair Hemshoot to Representative Elam, the 2.65 mils locally is your property tax. Interesting enough, in law, you can collect 4 mils, but your basic need is only 2.65. So local areas can collect up to 4 mils for education. Because prior in, I believe, 2012, it was changed from 4 mils. It was 4 mils at the state level. And the state level lowered its local share to 2.65 mils as basic need. But it didn't change the law that an area can collect 4 mils. So if a local borough wanted to collect 4 mils, they could. The only thing they need to give to schools is 2.65. However, many choose to go above that, and some provide 75% of what they can. Some provide 85% of what they possibly can, you know, to continue to collect taxes, and some provide 100% of what they can. What we're finding out is just for education is the 2.65, and they can collect 4 just for education. What we're finding out is that the overall taxes in some places, they have high property values. They want to give to their schools. But to stay in line, it's not a bad thing to want to give schools more money. It's just that the formula and the law says that you shall not, because our formula has said you may only have 25% difference between the lowest and the highest. So that 2.65 is your local contribution. And if you're noticing, as property values in Alaska go up, especially over the COVID time when they skyrocketed, local contribution has adjusted to that.
If I may follow up one more. So then what's the maximum potential percentage-wise of funding that a municipal-type area would be able to fund within the formula?
Through Co-Chair Hemshoot to Representative Elam, they have to do the 2.65 mils, and then each is calculated differently according they're allowed up to a – they have about a 25% difference, but that 2.65 mils is what they have to do, and then there's a 25% difference of what they can, and that's all based off of their local ADM, like how much they are collecting, how many students they have. So it's within the formula of how much money they totally get, and then they can do another 25%.
Thank you.
So it's different for Co-Chair Hemshoot. It's different for every district.
I'd like to ask Director Heineken to also address your questions. Director Heineken, if you could put your name on record.
Thank you. For the record, this is Heather Heineken. Through co-chair to Representative Elam, specifically to your question about additional funds and what they can be spent on, I wanted to just clarify a little bit. The commissioner did a great job overviewing all the extra funds that are going in, but the difference specifically is in the definition that the Federal Department of Education clarified for us, which includes, and I'm going to read a little bit from the actual definition. The term current expenditures means expenditures for free public education, including expenditures for administration, instruction, attendance and health services, pupil transportation to services, operations and maintenance of plants, fixed charges, and net expenditures to cover deficits for food service, student body activities, but does not include expenditures for community services, capital outlay, debt services, goes on a little bit more. But what I want to clarify there is historically the State Department of Education has always looked at our operation fund, which is where the impact aid money is deposited. That's everything is done by fund, and so our general fund, like UGF, would be 100 at a district. Well, historically, we were not looking at the food service fund, the transportation fund. Those are totally different funds. They have totally different fund numbers, so not the at the state level of the UGF. It would be like the public education fund or So they have different funds. So those revenues have to be included, and that's what we're trying to clarify, is that we're trying to align Alaska regulations with federal regulations so that we're including all the right things. And I apologize. Were there other things you wanted me to add to? The commissioner did a great job.
Representative Elam.
No, I thank you for the explanation. I guess I'm just kind of wondering what the maximum total contribution in the third grade version would be for what is the maximum allowable that a municipality could actually contribute and does a percentage of total funding if that's an answerable question. I don't know.
Through Co-Chair.
Through the chair to Rep. Elam, I think the commissioner clarified it as good as possible. It's part of the funding formula. We have a minimum and a maximum as we calculate basic need, but because of the variation, I'll use the word economies of scale, it's not a flat percentage rate that allows for the difference. We will follow up with the specifics on how that's calculated so you can have that information.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner, did you want to add?
Yes. Thank you, Co-Chair Himshute. It is a moving number according to that local area, and right. Because we're so different, but it would be approximately 25% difference between the basic need up to the max that you can.
Thank you.
I had a question. Anyone else in the committee? Okay. Commissioner, have we failed the disparity test before?
Co-Chair Himshute, I would like to turn it over to Heather Heineken. I am not aware that we have, because we've worked this again. And prior to 2019, we didn't include those other funds that we were supposed to. So we had lots of wiggle room. Since that time, it's been very close, but we have not failed the disparity test. Again, it's our job to not have that happen as the department, because that would literally cost the state $80 million that year.
Well, that's my second question. What happens if we do? Is it you fail it one time and this consequence happens, or do you get a grace period? Is there a hold harmless time? Do you have to fail three times? Like, what what happens if we fail?
Co-Chair Hemshire, that's a great question, and I'm not sure if we have those consequences. Certainly, the use of the law is written that if you use impact aid, you must have a formula that doesn't vary more than 25%. That's why they test it every year. If we fail outside of that, I don't know if they could waive it for a year. We could fix it. They would. But the cost to the state of not using impact aid as your basic need for areas that receive it is about $80 million. So we could choose not to even mess with this, but that's the fiscal note.
Could we change the 25% to 30%?
The federal laws, Co-Chair Hemshute, the federal law has stated a 25% disparity.
Okay.
In their regulation.
And were you thinking Director Morrison could answer whether we've ever failed, or was that Heather Heineken?
Co-Chair Hemshute, I'm hoping either could.
Okay, let's try Director Heineken, since you've already been on. Do you know if we've failed the disparity test before?
For the record, this is Heather Heineken. I actually am not aware of us failing the disparity test since I've been in education in Alaska. So I believe that the commissioner is correct, because we weren't including those funds previously. They were not, we weren't even close. In recent years, we've been much closer to the cap. But we will do some history research and follow up if we're incorrect, but I'm not aware of us ever failing. One other thing I can clarify, I pulled up the language in the funding formula to clarify the percentage in the foundation formula. So different question, I apologize. But to calculate the maximum local contribution, you use the required local contribution plus 23% of basic need, and those funds calculated on adjusted ADM or a 2 mil equivalent of the full and true valuation of the taxable and real property within the district, whichever of those two are greater. So that there's not a specific percent that we can say, but the 23%, 2 mils, that's all relevant to the calculation.
I apologize. I'd also like to add, Co-Chair Hemshute, that those are two different provisions, and majority of our school districts use the first, the 23%. Valdez and North Slope Borough School District use the set amount.
Okay, we are quickly running out of time. We have a very important bill we still want to hear today, but I wanted to invite Co-Chair Story back up to see if you had any additional comments on this bill.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Hemshute, and to committee members. I did want to say we did fail the disparity test a few years ago because of transportation fundings when this change happened in 2019. And the department worked with the Impact Aid Office, got a waiver as it applied to transportation. I'm not sure if I'm using the quite technical terms. Heidi Teschner, who was the former deputy commissioner, worked a lot on that and explained and worked with the federal government, understanding our unique geographic cost factors in providing transportation, just the wide disparity. Alaska often is unique, and I believe when we had testimony the other day, the department was said they might pursue a waiver in the nutritional area too, because our cost of transportation for nutrition, as we all know, are very different from most other states do. So I wanted to say there is some flexibility in this, and Adid has worked with departments like that. There is flexibility in the determination process that Deed could pursue in a lot of these categories that have been talked about. One of them is the extracurricular activities. I believe when Director Heineken read the federal definition, that it included student body activity. And the Juneau School District has spoken multiple times with the Impact Aid Office about the categories. And they have said per impact aid extracurricular activities occurring outside the instructional day and outside required curriculum do not necessarily have to count in the disparity test, as they are not curricular. They are not required across the state. The homeschool law, AS 14.30.365, allows non-district students to participate in high school interscholastic activities, which supports the interpretation that extracurricular activities in Alaska are not student body activities, part of free public education, and subject to the disparity test. So it's very important definitions and working together with the Impact Aid Office to help understand the unique parts of Alaska. So I want to say, and recognizing for time, this is equity is a complex issue, the changes the department is hoping to put in regulations, I do not believe will help us with equity, so to speak. We have a lot of questions about that. I believe we all do, and I know the department does want to have equity for our students across the state. I know that municipalities and I know that REAAs also receive extra funds. Maybe not from municipalities, but from Native corporations in the area. And if you noted the other day, the 25% who we can, when you do this disparity test, you can get rid of the top 5% wealthy, or who receive the most money, and the lowest 5%, and you work within the middle. Well, the REAAs are in that top 5%. Having gotten money from their local communities, their local regional corps, say, for an example. And so one thought I've had with working on this bill is this something that if our education bill passes and there is a task force formed, is this something that should be added to the task force to be exploring, because it is complex? But I want to say that, you know, it's important, really important to figure this out, because right now our expenses have not kept up for funding for our districts, and there are districts who want to voluntarily, in many ways, through REAs and through local municipalities, contribute to help kids not lose opportunity in these tough times. And so this is a very important bill, very important things to think about, and I'm happy to have any questions offline. To please send questions to my office, and I can help try and answer as we look at this important issue. So thank you very much, and I'm just going to close my comments, because we could talk about this for the whole hour, and it is important, I believe, to move on. So thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Story, and I think that question about transportation has been addressed, and we could continue to look at transportation as whether it's in or out. I know I have a district where there is no transportation. The kids live within blocks of school, so the only transportation there is to travel by airplane to school activities. So that's very different from the Matsu, where buses are going all over the place. So we need to move on, and I'm going to hand the gavel back to Co-Chair Story so that we can hear a very important bill this morning. Almost on time.
Thank you.
Oh, I totally forgot. Yeah, let me go back. I wanted to set a new amendment deadline on House Bill 212.
It's numbered on the bottom. Pages.
And so, let's set that new amendment deadline for Thursday, May 8th at 4 p.m. Thanks for catching that.
Sure.
And now we will go back to Co-Chair Story for our final bill.
Thank you. Today's final business is a hearing on House Bill 59, State Tribal Education Compact. This today is an introductory presentation by Dr. Joel Isaac, and Commissioner Bishop with Deed is also here. This bill moved out of Tribal Affairs Committee last week. Rep. Hemshute and I thought it was really important to have a hearing on the bill today, because we just thought it would be important to have a presentation. And then we also invited a couple of superintendents from the districts where the tribal compacting schools will be located to talk about challenges and opportunities. And I think it will help the tribal compacting schools over the interim, and districts ask some, get some questions from the committee. And so as we look at this bill starting in January, we will, there'll be some, a first presentation and some more input hopefully to give to Dr. Isaacs and our school, our tribal schools that are hoping to come on board. So welcome Dr. Bishop and Dr. Isaac. Please come forward, introduce yourself for the record, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Hemshute and Story and House Education Committee. For the record, my name is Dina Bishop.
Yagulidu, Slek Ayistan Inishiji, Joel Isaac. For the record, I'm a consultant for the Department of Education Early Development. It's good to see you all this morning. Thanks.
Thank you. And as I just want to give it a shout out. This is Dr. Joel Isaac, and he was hooded this year, so I want to congratulate him on that. So thank you. I always like to say that he hates it, but I love it. It's a lot of work, so thank you. So thank you. I just want to begin by just sharing some backdrop in regard to House Bill 59. Many years ago, actually in about 2013-14, a group of 300 Alaskans were chosen from around the state by then Governor Walker to come together to decide what is it that our state would like for public education. And it became known as Alaska's Challenge, and it was adopted and set forth as a strategic plan for our state in 2016. And at that time in 2016, one of the items of Alaska's Challenge was to focus on tribal compacting for public education. Since that time, much work has been done, and it culminated in 2022 with Senate Bill 34 as a priority. And Dr. Isaac will share a little bit more about this. Since then, 3 years ago, we have completed and carried out the objectives and actions requested in Senate Bill 34, and we come before you today with House Bill 59 to move forward with this innovative and exciting educational opportunity for all Alaskans, understanding cultural context as well as lots of hands-on learning, again, for all Alaskans, organized and driven by Alaska's tribal entities that are participating in the demonstration of House Bill 59. I'll turn it over to, actually, I'll do our intro of these slides.
Excuse me for a second, Commissioner. Rep. Hemshute, you have a comment?
I'm sorry, I'm being fussy, but Alaska's Education Challenge was 2016 and adopted in 2018 or 2019. So the years are just a little bit different, just okay. Because it was Commissioner Johnson, and I don't think he came on board until 16 or even 17. So anyway, it was a little bit later.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed, Dr. Isaac.
To begin, the mission, vision, and purpose, again, for Alaska's Department of Education, these are the adopted mission, vision, and purpose from the State Board of Education. Here is what I was mentioning, meeting Alaska's education challenge. And then, agenda as a backdrop, I'll turn it over to Dr. Isaac.
Jeanne, for the record, Joel Isaac, to the chair and to the committee. The agenda for today, we're going to move kind of quickly through parts of this. Because of the long amount of decades that have gone into this work, kind of putting positionality for how we got here today has been shown to help with developing understanding and the questions that relate. So we're going to do that brief backdrop. The commissioner has talked through that a little bit already. The progression from Senate Bill 34 into House Bill 59. We'll do an introductory overview of HB 59. And then there is a document that was provided that's a cross-reference between HB 59 as a note. That's a cross-reference before the committee substitute. And that shows the year, some of the years were amended in the committee substitute from House Tribal Affairs, but some of this, again, is the historical how we got here, so I just want to make a note. Those documents are labeled accordingly. And then there's two resources. The Alaska Federation of Natives has a website that is rich with lots of white papers, interviews. If you're a federal Indian law and policy legal nerd, it's a great place to go. And then the Cook Inlet Tribal Council, the department also had worked with for about a year and a half, looking at what does success look like? And it's an interactive website that shows over 600 interviews that were conducted, and you can listen to them, you can see them. The goal was a snapshot of the state, so that it's the question of, if we're doing a pilot and we want to evaluate efficacy, how do we know this is working, and how do we know what's working from a tribally led voice for tribal education is part of the impetus for that grant and that work. So those links are provided. So moving on to slide 5. Is how is compacting different in education than Indian Health Service, which is acronym is IHS, and the State Child Welfare Service compacts. Compacting is not new in Alaska, but each one operates a little bit differently. The two mentioned models are whole system approaches, where you can then select services within that. So for example, when the IHS has a block of money, you can choose to negotiate with them as a tribe and say, you have $5 million for cardiology. These things are appropriately billed for. You can't bill for these things, and you get to negotiate what those are. So another example is for audiology. In my IHS clinic at home, you can go in and have an appointment, a referral to Anchorage, and you can have that referral covered, but you pay for your hearing aids. So that's an example of what was negotiated, because there's only so much money, and the tribes negotiate how they like to spend those funds. The difference in education, as you are all well aware of, is a foundation formula. And so it's not just a block that is determined and you can negotiate from. So that's a context that's important for how the money comes to be that's relevant to this bill. And then also looking at that affects how the negotiations take place. So on slide 6, as we started the negotiations, what does compacting look like in education? Our first face-to-face negotiation, we spent about 3 hours figuring out what the roles were and what the report would contain. Senate Bill 34 called for a demonstration. So if you think about basically a proof of concept and a pathway that's outlined for future legislation for a pilot to become active. So we looked at the state role, funding, accountability, due process, State Board of Education, one system of education, so this is under Alaska state constitution. The tribal role is more of the operator. So looking at these tribally compacted public schools, the staff are employees of the tribe, curriculum, local governance, training staff, and reporting. So that's the high-level overview of what the roles are. So on slide 7, what is compacting? It's a government-to-government agreement. Tribes, as federally recognized tribes, are a form of government. The state is a form of government. It's technically a political subdivision, is another way that you might hear if you're listening to tribes or technical legal presentations, is political subdivisions. It makes it different to where it's not a special interest group, it's not a racial category, it's a political subdivision like a country. So if you think, for me as an individual, I'm a tribal citizen, I'm also a citizen within the United States of America, it's a nation-to-nation agreement. At that federal level, tribes are included in the U.S. Constitution back in the 1700s. They were recognized as part of the U.S. Constitution. And the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act is part of what outlines tribes' authority to do the compacting agreement process. So as we go into the progression, the question that I asked House Tribal Affairs as we segue from that, in the ISDEA is an acronym, the Indian Self-Determined Education Assistance Act, I asked to think back to where were you in 1990? And for me, I was getting ready to go into school. In the early 90s is when I started school. If I asked another question, where were you in the early 1970s? I was not here on this planet in my current form. These are when these compacting conversations were starting. So when we say this is not a new idea, I think back to the 70s. Think back to the 90s. The 90s conversation was specific to compacting because the Indian Health Service compact was coming online then. But that work was built on efforts in the 1970s from the Alaska Native Health Board's policy advocacy efforts that changed a congressional act. So that's what our state right now is in that historic timeline. It's very exciting to be part of this work because it's these shifts that fundamentally create new outcomes. And that one of those outcomes for the Indian Health Service model, how do you measure it? Our Alaska Native people are living longer. So for me, again, as a male Native American, my life expectancy is under 70 years old. In the 70s, it was barely hitting 60 years old. So in my lifetime, my life expectancy has almost increased a decade because of the effects of compacting in healthcare. I say that because we have that same opportunity in education. It's taken 30 years to get there, and the sooner we can start the compacting, the sooner we see that growth, and it's our kids that benefit from this. And because this is public education, similar to how eligibility factors for IHS, you can be non-native and be seen at an IHS clinic, for example, but because this is public education, all of our kids across the state, not just those eligible for IHS services, all kids can benefit from that. So it's really something we as a collective in Alaska get to see transform. And that's one of those pieces as we go into the negotiation process for Senate Bill 34. Is this transformational and is this best for a kid? That is the two guiding questions for all of the things that we went through with our state negotiations with the tribal partners and also the consultation with the teachers union and our local school districts. Those two questions. We did consultation with the districts. We did teacher consultation or teacher union consultation. This was all with the state board public meetings. There were quarterly public meetings. There were monthly meetings that public could comment on and call into. There were reports to the legislature. So we've had 3 years of public process that have led to HB 59 and then introductory hearings.
Thank you, Dr. Isaac. Just a quick question. Sorry to interrupt there. Is that public testimony? Could you get that written public testimony to the committee? I think that'd be helpful to see.
To the chair, Joel Isaac, yes, we'll be able to follow up with that.
Thank you.
You know, the next slide, please. Slide 9. So the department put out an application for prepared funds for the tribal partners to negotiate. It was about a 9-10 month negotiation period that was very intense. We did about 2,000 hours of work in about under 9 months. And so the application criteria is shown here on slide 9. We can go to the next slide and slide 10, and I'll pause here. One of the things I want to highlight is the diverse representation priority. What we mean by diverse, and we being the state board approved this application process, which is available on the Deed Compacting website, geographic diversity, methodology, school size, and community size. Part of a pilot is we want to make sure this works across the entire state. Alaska's big, it's small in different ways, all those things that, again, you've been hearing about 100 days of how Alaska is specific and unique. So this was part of the goal from the state board, realizing we needed a statewide snapshot. So the board received 5 applications that were very high scoring applications. These are the tribal partners. Just as a note, King Island Native Community was a consortium model. It's a partnership between King Island Native Community, which is the name of the tribe, and the Native Village of Solomon. They work together. So even our process of negotiation showed how do tribes work as a consortium model. So that was proved effective. This is the timeline. We had one virtual meeting and then everything else was face-to-face and hybrid. These were face-to-face meetings in Anchorage. And again, the department provided those grant awards so that tribes had funding to travel and also for legal counsel. So on slide 13, you can see we also, these are again public schools looking out. We negotiated with the tribes and then the consultations. We had a specific meeting with superintendents before we brought the tribes and the superintendents together. So we talked with the tribes as we being the department and the department and the districts, and we brought the three together. It gave the safe space to be able to ask the hard questions and not feel like, am I offending somebody? I don't know how to say this, and those kinds of safe spaces to be able to be very direct and honest and bring back to that question, is this best for kids? We also did presentations at the Alaska Association of School Boards, to the AFN, Elders and Youth, with First Alaskans, and then also ALASBO, the Alaska Association of School Business Officials. So on slide 14, this is the pilot, and I call it Transformation Action. If you were to distill down the bill into these This is what the bill does. The premise, public schools open to all students and funded through public dollars. The mechanism, again, is that government-to-government agreement, that state-tribal level. And then the operation, this is one of the key pieces of looking at how the bill functions. So the tribes would function as a school district and set up their local governing body. And then also the tribe has the, in this bill, is tasked with developing the training methodology to align with the governance structure, the pedagogy the tribe is doing, and make sure the teachers meet that pedagogy and the state requirements under Title 14 and the promulgated regulations. The staff would be employees of the tribe, with the tribe functioning as a school district. And then there's the accountability factors, background checks, certification that's still required under the state, and then making sure kids are safe with buildings, all those kinds of accountability, doing the report to the legislature. The other thing that I bring up as accountability is before the school operates, there has to be a negotiated compact agreement. Within that agreement, there are clauses for how to do mediation if there's compliance issues. So even before the doors open, there is a plan to address how to make sure our kids are receiving high-quality education within the structure of the law, and that's part of that accountability factor of having a compact agreement before the funds flow. And then the evaluation, tribes writing an annual progress report to the legislature through the Department of Education, just like all other school districts do. And then if the bill passes now, it'd be 5 years from now, which is 2 years before the sunset clause. And that was the amendment that was appreciated in House Tribal Affairs so that the legislature can start looking at the efficacy of the pilot to move future legislation forward. So that's the bill in a nutshell. If we go to the next slide, I want to provide this. I find it a riveting report that's about 76 pages, and the link is there for the PDF. You can see there's an introduction, there's findings. We did all those months of negotiation, and we didn't want to lose that good thinking, but also we want to be transparent. So the findings section has a tribal voice side, and then alongside the same topic area, there's the state voice. So you can see what were the things that we talked about, where could we develop consensus and come forward with a unified voice between the tribes and the State Board of Education and approved by the Governor's Office and the Law Department and LRLR for drafting purposes. There's a draft compact agreement. And again, this is draft. It's not executed as far as there's no signatures, but it gives a good framework for what is shown in HB 59. And then Section 4 was statutory framework. That, rather than drafting a bill, which was legally permissible under Senate Bill 34, we did a framework so that in plain English, you could understand what was being discussed. And then that's part of the cross-reference document that we've supplied to the committee to show those statutory frameworks and how they show up in the bill under the legalese. And then Section 5 is a conclusion. And that and the appendices that are shown in the resources for AFN and CITC. So again, coming back to transformation, and we talked about the five components of it. That conclusion piece ends with a question from the CITC video that we showed in House Tribal Affairs and House Education last year. Well, I anticipate we'll show it again in the future. But I'm going to paraphrase the ending quote, which is it's a question to those of us who have seats at the table and have historically had seats at the table. What will you do to make this happen? We all, I'm going to say myself included, as I'm sitting here at a table that has the ability to speak with you all, what will we do to work together to transform education for our kids through this method? And that's the conclusion of the compacting report. I'm going to move through some of the slides a little bit. Let's go to slide 19. This is the mechanism that I discussed where the tribally compacted public school districts would be, again, public schools. They function as a school district. This bill functions as uncodified law, so nothing in Title 14 is being opened up and amended. And like Mount Edgecombe functions as a school district, these compacted public school districts function as a district. What this does is it allows to work with existing Title 14 statutes without amending them And that's the mechanism. And then the governance is the tribes set up their own governing bodies. And then looking at funding per the foundation formula, this is slide 20 for looking at the funding findings. So using adjusted average daily membership, because tribes currently do not have the taxing authority, again, you got a presentation on the details of taxing authority this morning, so that was a helpful segue into this one. Functioning as a regional education attendance area is how the formula would generate the dollars, again, using adjusted average daily membership just like any other school district does. And then the teachers and school personnel. So I highlighted or bolded a section, but the Cliff Notes version of this is that the tribe is responsible for making sure the teachers have the appropriate training. That could be in partnership with university classes. It could be a degree program. It could be a combination of those mentioned things. It has to follow state law. And then the tribe, as part of the negotiation process, communicates with the department, this is our training protocol. The department has that on file. If a teacher needs to be certified by the tribe, sends this employee's essentially transcript to the department and says, I've done my training. The department makes sure, does the background checks, and then issues teacher licensure. So the department does the licensure, which is that accountability. It's the verification. The tribe's role is to do the training itself. And then, we'll go back one more. The retirement system in the bill, the retirement system is the same retirement system that any other teacher in the state currently uses for TERS, PERS, et cetera. So that's one of the other notes. This is from the report, but the bill is specific to using that one system of retirement. Thank you. We can go to slide 23. So this is the cross-reference. I put the three blue color-coded. I'm an educator. I like to color-code the things. And so the supporting document that is the cross-reference between HB 59 and Senate Bill 34 shows these three areas. And you can see it has the bill page number, the bill lines, and then the report language is color-coded. So it kind of brings those two together. And that's, again, it's a separate document, not in this presentation. And then the conclusion, I'm just going to, this is from President Peterson with Central Haida. Tribal compacting has the potential to enhance education delivery. Compacting is looking at a system, delivery system. That's the transformation that we're looking at with this. It's not aimed at people. It's aimed at the system to empower people to do what's best for kids. And again, this is just the conclusion summary. If someone asks what's in HB 59, this is where I always send them to. And it has these five components to it. Let me go to the next one. This is the appendix from the report. So these are guideposts. If you're looking through the report, that's the page you're looking for. And then we have our pilot evaluation. This has the website for AFN's tools. This is a screenshot from the website, so you can see the resources are on the sidebar and how to navigate to the AFN website. And then on slide 28, this is the ourfutureancestors.com is the website that Cook Inlet Tribal Council generated. And then the video for Our Future Ancestors, A Story of Education in Alaska, is included there as well. There is a newsletter sign up if you're wondering how do I stay up to date on all things tribal education, specifically compacting as well. If you go to the department's compacting website, there's a newsletter sign up button and you put your email address and then you receive emails. And then our contact information from the state representatives, and we included the tribal contact information also. So that is the kind of in the weeds how we got to the bill. I can pause if that would be appropriate and do a brief sectional summary. Most of the sectional summary I kind of included in the presentation, but I, with the chair, for how you'd like to proceed, I'm happy to do a more formal sectional summary.
Thank you for that, Dr. Isaac, and thank you for that overview. And I realize it was hard to summarize all these years of work, but it is a great place to show us where all the resources are, the first report, things that I hope we are reading and looking into, you know, in the interim. But I think I'm going to open it up for if there's any questions right now, and then I think I'm going to go to the superintendents online, just hear their thoughts of any of challenges, opportunities, questions that the committee should be looking into, and then we'll come back, and at that time we can do a deeper dive if the committee wants, but I just figure we might have some questions, and I just think it's really important to have a dialogue right now and go forward. Did I have any questions right now from committee members? Rep. Schwanke.
Thank you, Dr. Story. Through the chair to Dr. Isaac, I'm hoping that you can describe to the committee a little bit more kind of a continuation of the conversation that we had with the last bill, but it surrounds in particular funding opportunities, especially for some of our rural communities where we don't have taxing authority and we don't have local contribution opportunities. You aptly noted that tribal organizations do not have taxing authority and they don't have the ability to raise funds, which is why this is a public funding project and request. Could you describe for the committee the very significant differences between tribal organizations that would be running these tribal compact schools and our corporations, which we do know that in some parts of our state are able and are offering some significant funding, but we have the vast majority of our state, our Native corporations, are not providing additional funds to our public education model. So if you could just kind of describe the difference between those for the committee, I think that would be very helpful.
I very much appreciate the question, Joe Isaac, for the record, through the chair to Representative Schwanke. So Alaska, when we're in D.C. and talking with our federal Department of Education folks, they often say you need a master's degree to understand Alaska tribal landscape. And so I'll give a brief answer to that question. Is that the federally recognized tribes function as tribal governments, again, that nationhood. The corporations are not governments. The corporations can provide some services that tribal governments can provide, and that's usually done at a federal level for bill appropriation language. And so that's looking at the difference. A tribal corporation or a tribal corporation nonprofit, an ANCSA, Alaska Native Claims Settlement Acts, regional corporation like CIRI, NANA, just as two examples, ASRC, another, there's more than that, three. There's also village ANCSA corporations, and they're not the regional ones. There's regional and village. So those corporations can set up foundations to provide services for their shareholders, and that is different than being a citizen or a member of a tribe. They're, because the federal distinctions, sometimes they play in the same sandbox and carry out similar services. Sometimes they're different. A tribal government, through resolution, can identify this corporation on my behalf will provide these services because that's their authority as a tribal government. The key piece with all of this scenario is in 1985-86, the Stevens Rider, which is a congressional amendment, precludes the Bureau of Indian Affairs, this predated the BIE, Bureau of Indian Affairs, from giving money to Alaska for school day funding and for school construction, and transferred all BIA assets, the land or the physical schools, to the state of Alaska. So there is no direct federal funding coming to our state for school day education. If a corporation chooses to donate to a school, that is the exact same mechanism that ConocoPhillips, for example, as a corporation that does oil, as does many of our other village native corps do oil, it's the same way. So that's the way that it functions. It doesn't go into local contribution levels. It's the way that anyone else, any entity, corporation, does donation to a school. It can be to a school district. It can be earmarked for a specific service, like the ConocoPhillips computer lab. for example, the BP computer lab in my middle school. Those kinds of things, a regional corporation can do that. They are not legally obligated to do that. And typically, what I, from the 6.5 years of the department, the conversations that I have with the corporation or the foundations, there is a alignment with the services that are being carried out. So, for example, language, culture, STEAM, STEM, where a corporation might donate to that enterprise because it aligns with what the corporation sees their shareholders needing to do. That there's tax laws that go on with that as well for donations. We explore those in the compacting report. But just to be clear, there is not special other education money that exists for the corporations. And there also the corporations donate within organized boroughs, unorganized, incorporated. For example, Siak Cook Inlet Tribal Council is a nonprofit arm of the Siri Corporation, and they donate funds within Anchorage and within Kenai and their area all the way up to Bristol Bay also. So that's just I can go further. I might pause there. That's just some of the landscape that when we bring up corporations, what we're looking at for how funds flow.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to take one more question with Rep. Elam and then go to the superintendents online. Thank you, Rep.
Thank
Elam.
You. So you got into some of the nuances of the governing power or the governing, but I'm wondering if you could explain maybe a little bit more within the governing powers of the native governing bodies, right? So the tribal governments, and do you guys have education powers?
Through the chair to Representative Elam, Joel Isaac, for the record, the tribes do have sovereignty to set up their own education committees, their own education boards. For example, ICAST, the Inupiaq Community Arctic Slope, has one, and they issue formal government findings. They, this last week, issued a state of emergency for education for their tribal area, so that tribes have that authority. There is no funding mechanism for tribes to receive funding because typically, tribes receive federal funding through that trust responsibility at the federal level, but the Stephen Ryder has precluded that since the 80s, and before that, the BIA functioned where it was using that. The BIA was doing the services. So the authority to carry out education, yes, that aligns within the sovereignty of the tribe. What we're looking at, a compact is an agreement for public services, so the state is agreeing that this would be a public state tribal public school, which is different than a tribal school. Currently under state law, for a tribe to do that, which ICAS, for example, is currently doing that. There are other tribes that do also. Under state law, they're considered a private school, even though they're meeting all the provisions of the state constitution for being free, open enrollment, and they meet the federal requirement, our state law does not recognize them as being a tribal public school. So that's part of why we're coming forward with this bill. Commissioner?
Thank you. And just to add, just because I have had experience in Anchorage with CITC specifically, through chair co-chairs Himshute and co-chair Story, CITC does offer educational services, and the disconnect, and one of the things that we continually try to work on, is how through their coursework, and this is the troubling part and the difficulty, the sticker, is that it's high-quality education, but students cannot earn credits because the school district and the state kind of own that governance structure. So unless they come to the table and agree that that course counts, there is a career technical facilities, those discovery labs, tech labs, really around our state that Native corporations have invested in, and they struggle with having their students who put many, many hours and achieve and pass these tests to get school credit for earning of those, and it's and so this provides an opportunity for diplomas and school credits and things to be more seamless, both for students who choose to continue to learn within their local school district or choose to continue to learn in a tribal entity. That those certificates, and that's where I see the biggest impact, is the ability to provide an Alaska diploma, the ability to provide Alaska
credits for courses that are quite defined through certification.
Thank you for that. I would like to now go online. We have with us online today Dr. Michael Robbins. He's the superintendent of the Ketchikan School District. And if you could please unmute yourself, Dr. Robbins, and begin your comments.
Good morning, and thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Michael Robbins, and I serve as the superintendent of schools of the Ketchikan Gateway Borough School District. And I am here to express my strong support for HB 59 and to respectfully urge this committee to move the bill forward. The legislation provides an important opportunity to advance culturally responsive education across Alaska. By authoring state tribal education compacts, we are offering tribal communities the ability to operate public schools in the way that reflect their values, language, and traditions, while still meeting the educational standards and public accountability our state requires. This is not just about autonomy, it's about equity. HB 59 ensures that the Native Alaskan students and all students can benefit from educational models that are both academically rigorous and culturally grounded. These compact schools will allow students to learn from individuals who are true experts, not only in academic content, but in community history, culture, and identity. That is an asset that too often goes untapped in our current educational system. Students deserve increased access to high-quality coursework and innovative instructional approaches, whether it's through language preservation, land-based learning, or culturally rich content. These expanded opportunities help all students stay engaged and connected to their education. And importantly, this bill creates a space for school districts and tribal compacting schools to work together as partners in education. That partnership is critical, not just in sharing resources, ideas, but in creating mutual respect and collaboration that benefits students across the board. By aligning our efforts, we can support students' success on every front, increasing graduation rates, reducing dropout rates, and strengthening outcomes for every learner in our state. In Ketchikan, we've seen the positive impact firsthand. The demonstration project has been successful in our district. We've been able to collaborate meaningfully and continue strengthening our relationship with our tribal partners. As a result of this partnership and shared focus, we have increased the Native Alaskan graduation in our brick-and-mortar schools by 13%, the highest it's ever been. We are proud of the open communication this work has fostered, and we remain grounded in a shared purpose to make sure our students are successful, connected, and supported. This bill also preserves connections to the past. It allows schools to honor and pass on cultural knowledge while preparing students for the future, continuing to make those connections to the past to benefit the future. As a superintendent, I also want to acknowledge that the bill is designed with structures and accountability in mind. The provisions related to legal compliance, retirement systems, audits, and annual performance reporting shows that this is a serious, thoughtful framework. However, I do want to respectfully suggest that the bill include a hold harmless provision for funding to support school districts that may experience enrollment shifts as compact schools open. We all know how critical enrollment is to district financial stability. Potentially having hundreds of students move out of our district would create a hardship for Ketchikan Gateway Borough School District. We may lose special programs like CTE programming, music, art, and other programs like the AVID curriculum that we have in Ketchikan. The state already has funding mechanisms in place to help districts during transitional periods. Applying these tools here would make the transition smoother for both districts and compacting schools. It would foster collaboration instead of competition. I believe this would be a fair and equitable way to move forward together. In closing, this bill is not about creating exceptions. It's about creating opportunities. It reflects a future where Alaska's education system is more inclusive, more flexible, and more responsible to the communities we serve and the place-based learning that we try to teach. I strongly support HB 59 and hope you move it forward. Thank you for your time and your continued commitment to Alaska students. Koyana Chuknuk.
Thank you, Dr. Robbins. Do I have any questions from committee members at this time? Rep. Hemshoot.
Thank you, through the chair. Dr. Robbins, I just wanted to make sure you referred to existing systems. Are you specifically talking about hold harmless, or what are you suggesting?
Yes, there? Ma'am. The mechanisms that we have in place for hold harmless when enrollment drops or when a school closure is concerned, those mechanisms seem to be effective throughout the state, and I think that that's one that I was looking at as far as implementation.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, I appreciate you calling in today, and we will go next to Superintendent Jamie Burgess, who is with the Nome Public Schools. Burgess. I am so sorry, and I have known you quite a while, so I'm sorry, Dr. Burgess. Please, Burgess. Sorry. Okay. Dr. Burgess.
Good morning, Representative Story. You're forgiven. Yeah. That's okay. I'm very used to having my name mispronounced frequently. Can you guys all hear me okay? It looks like it. You're all ready to chuckle.
I'm sorry.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. My name is Jamie Burgess, and I'm the superintendent for Nome Public Schools. So the tribes of King Island and Solomon have joined together and were selected as one of the demonstration projects for a school in Nome. My testimony will be a little different than Dr. Robbins, as my focus will be to share with you a little bit about how our original consultation process that we went through and how we are considering how the how logistics might work between a district like Nome and the project for the school. So as part of the required consultation between Nome Public Schools and the tribal representatives for King Island Native Community and the Village of Solomon, we discussed what their envisioned spec school might look like. The tribes indicated at the time that they planned eventually to construct their own building, but to start would likely request to utilize available space at Nome Elementary School. To give you a little background, Nome is about a 4,000-person community with four different tribes headquartered here. Nome Eskimo community represents the indigenous people who are from this location, and three tribes were relocated here, Solomon, Council, and King Island, from their original ancestral lands. Nome has a little less than 700 students total attending its three brick-and-mortar schools, and we also have a homeschooling program. The enrollment for Nome Public Schools has dropped a bit over the past several years, and we currently would have 1 to 2 classrooms available for this tech school to use. Our entry cohort is approximately 60 students in a normal year, but we have several smaller cohorts moving through the early grades, resulting in us cutting a position at both first and second grade for the FY26 school year. So Nome is already in a whole harmless situation due to our enrollment drop for the past several years. The discussion with a STEC school also touched briefly on logistics that the STEC school wished and that Nome could provide in return for financial consideration, likely through a memorandum agreement. These could include rental of our physical space, transportation, since all of Nome is served by our busing system, special education services, and federal programs services. Meals for students would have to be worked out, as well as if STEC students would participate in our specials, such as PE and library. Initially, the tribes indicated that their desire was to create an Inupiaq immersion program and would start with pre-K and kindergarten. Depending on the enrollment, this could mean anywhere between 20 to 40 students shifting from Nome Public Schools to the STEC school in the first year that they are open. This decrease in enrollment would move Nome Public Schools back into the first year of hold harmless, which applies when a district sees a enrollment decrease of 5% or greater in its brick and mortar programs. There would be a financial offset to some extent, by rent of our physical space, as well as any other services the new entity would wish to contract from us. I don't know how long this arrangement might last. However, the district would likely need to reduce the number of classroom teachers for the following year, depending on the number of students that chose to enroll in the spec school. There is the potential for loss of special teachers, although we would likely just right-size our classrooms to keep them within the desired class size of 20 students per elementary grade level. I do not know if the spec school desires to eventually grow to a K-12 school. My initial impression is that they wanted to start out and were planning at pre-K through fifth grade. Curriculum sharing between our two schools would be challenging if the spec school is an immersion program. The public schools originally did have an immersion classroom for 3 years at kindergarten and first grade. The immersion teachers had a great deal of work to do to translate as many curriculum materials as they could into Inupiaq. There was an expectation that they would still utilize the district-adopted reading and math program. However, as a spec school, they could choose to adopt a different curriculum, and I would assume it would be offered fully in Inupiaq. NELP does provide place-based learning, and it is in the process of concluding.
Oh, Superintendent Burgess.
Burgess,
I can't do that. Burgess. Burgess. Superintendent Burgess, we lost you. Okay, we'll see if she calls back in just the next few minutes while I practice her name.
I love you so much, Andrea. The brain does interesting things.
Do I get a J?
Yeah, I'll take a brief at ease. We're back online. Superintendent Burgess, could you please continue with your presentation?
Yes, so I apologize for that technical difficulties. Okay. I was at NELM that provides place-based learning and is in the process of including more Indigenous books into its elementary reading program. However, we no longer offer the immersion program as our Inupiaq speaking teachers have left employment with the district. Long term, it would be difficult to predict the impact on NELM public schools. Running two elementary programs in a community where the elementary school population is around 300 might cause some challenges for a district if the split was fairly equal. If the spec school builds its own facility, they may not no longer need any services from NELM public schools. The spec schools also would have access to funding that a public school would not. And so at some point, we would presume that it would then become independent entirely from working with the public system. There would also be some challenges with transitioning students out of a full immersion program into middle school grades and a full English program. Responsibility for handling that transition would fall on the public school system unless the spec school built a transition year into their school. They could also opt to continue adding grades to go K-12 if there is sufficient interest in enrollment, which would impact their staffing at the middle to high school grades. That is more challenging to handle due to the shift into content-focused teachers and classes at that level. For the public schools, it feels a little bit like we may be moving into uncharted territory. We do wish to support our tribal partners and our communities, but for a district that serves a community with a high population of Alaska Native students, the future is a little bit murky. We will adapt as we always do. From my perspective as a superintendent, I would like to see some case studies of other tribally compacted schools starting in small communities and how partners with local schools were handled and the impact on those districts over time so we can know what to expect. I do want to make it clear that we are supportive of House Bill 59. We recognize that our local Native tribes and community has the ability to decide what they want for education for their children. We are happy to support the development of a STEP school if that does move forward. However, I believe that there are still a great deal of questions for some schools. How it impacts each community is going to be unique. A STEP school in a larger district such as Anchorage or even Ketchikan, which is about three times the size of Nome, would have a different impact. However, I am here to answer any questions, and I do support House Bill 59 and would like to see it move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent Burgess.
Sort of. Burgess. Almost Burgess.
Do I have any questions from the committee members at this time? I do not see any questions. I really appreciate the Commissioner, Dr. Isaac, being here, our superintendents, and I think it's really important, committee members. As we heard the presentation today, and some of us have been on tribal affairs, and so as we dig more into the bill and how it impacts our education community and can complement each other and work together, I think it's important. Any questions that you have? And I was going to say, in the interim, if you have questions, please send them to Rep. Hemshute or myself, and we will make sure Dr. Isaac gets those questions. And the commissioner, I think it's just really important that we continue in the interim to think and contemplate on this. So I want to look at what we're going to be doing on Friday. House Education Committee will be hearing House Bill 190, Child Care Assistance Tax Credit, as well as HJR pertaining to hire of international educators by Representative Mina, pending introduction and referral, as well as House Bill 212, Local Contribution. And a reminder to the committee, we are invited to tour the Department of Education and Early Development on Friday morning. We hope to leave here about 9. And so just wanted to give the reminder and a thanks to everyone today. This concludes the committee hearing. The time is 9:56. Thank you, committee members and all, for your comments. Appreciate it. And we are adjourned.